BBC World Service, this is Owen Bennett-Jones with a special programme on the Asian earthquake. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be looking back over a disastrous week in Asia. It began with a mammoth underground earthquake, which released a vast amount of energy pulsating through the ocean.
The entire sea is moving up and down. It's not like wind-driven waves where the wind just causes the surface of the water to move or to build up into waves. This is the whole of the sea from top to bottom going up and down and forming these waves that travel as fast as a jumbo jet in deep water across the ocean.
And when the wave hit the shore, it slowed down and reared into the air before crashing down on people unlucky enough to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
People are running, some people who went to take their children and all that got stuck in the middle of the waves, corpses are floating.
Stay tuned for this special programme on the tsunami wave. But first, let's get the world news in full.
BBC News with David Ryder. A week after huge waves devastated coastal areas around the Indian Ocean, an international relief operation is struggling to get aid to stricken areas. Around $2 billion has been raised so far, but appalling weather is complicating the relief effort. Official figures for those killed or presumed dead continue to rise, and United Nations agencies fear the total may exceed 150,000. An estimated 5 million have been left short of water, food or sanitation. The UN Under-Secretary for Humanitarian Affairs, Margareta Wallström, has been touring Sri Lanka, where nearly 30,000 are confirmed dead. She said it was a tremendous challenge to coordinate the huge amounts of international aid.
The physical destruction is incredible here. Many communities have just been turned into absolute rubble. So to assist people in regaining some normalcy in their lives, we have to start looking at livelihoods. The fishing industry has been completely destroyed. Fishing boats need to be repaired. Harbors have been destroyed.
U.S. Navy helicopters have been dropping emergency food supplies to isolated communities in Indonesia, but it's still proving difficult to get significant quantities of aid to the worst affected areas in Aceh province. A U.S. spokesman said more than 5,000 American troops have been deployed there and in neighboring Thailand. Commander Ike Skelton, the spokesman for the 7th Fleet, explained the usefulness of their equipment for the quake victims.
We have some maritime pre-positioning ships, large cargo ships loaded with stocks of food and fresh water. And from the U.S. Navy 7th Fleet, we have CTF-73 has actual water purification devices in those ships.
The Indonesian Cabinet Minister coordinating relief in Aceh, Alwi Shihab, praised the American effort. He said the authorities in the provincial capital Banda Aceh were burying at least 3,500 bodies each day. Police in Thailand say thousands of local people are still missing, presumed dead, in Ban Man Ken, a town in Pangar province, away from the main tourist resorts. A local police captain in Ban Man Ken said he thought some 3,000 were unaccounted for, but as many were undocumented illegal Burmese immigrants, he said the exact figure would never be known. Ban Man Ken suffered some of the worst devastation in Thailand. A BBC correspondent who visited the town said it was totally destroyed and people had lost everything. You're listening to the news from the BBC. The Indian Army says planes have managed to drop supplies of food and water to all the inhabited islands in the Andaman and Nicobar chain, some of which are only a short distance from the epicentre of last Sunday's earthquake. There's been criticism that the aid operation was far too slow in getting up and running. On the island of Car Nicobar alone, at least 10,000 people are thought to be either dead or missing. Our correspondent Jonathan Charles is one of the first outsiders to have reached the island.
Car Nicobar military airbase was devastated by the earthquake and sea surges. Around the damaged landing strip lie dozens of collapsed buildings. Search teams are continuing to look through the rubble for the many bodies still underneath. More than 100 Indian Air Force personnel and their families were killed here. Just a few of the 10,000 inhabitants thought to be either dead or missing. The runway's barely serviceable, but the Indian military is now managing to fly in plane loads of supplies, water and food, which is desperately needed by survivors. In the coastal village of Malacca, I saw nothing but ruins, every house crushed by the wall of water, which arrived without warning.
In Sri Lanka, where nearly 30,000 are now confirmed dead, the authorities are focusing on preventing the spread of waterborne diseases following flash floods, which have made further 30,000 people homeless. The flooding has wrecked sanitation arrangements and increased the risk of sickness. The World Health Organization says there are increasing reports of potentially deadly outbreaks of diarrhea in displacement camps in badly hit regions of Sri Lanka and India. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, is particularly concerned about the safety of many children who've been orphaned by the disaster. David Bell is UNICEF's executive director in Britain.
We need to protect those children. We've heard cases from Indonesia already of children being taken away by unknown adults. And we need to get them back into a situation of some semblance of normality, get them into school. We also need to protect them against disease and in places like Sri Lanka against landmines which have been shifted by the waves.
The Israeli army has launched new incursion into the northern part of the occupied Gaza Strip in what it says is an attempt to stop more Palestinian mortar and rocket attacks. Witnesses said some 50 Israeli tanks and other armoured vehicles poured into the Beit Hanun area close to the border with Israel. And that's the latest bulletin of BBC World Service News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with a special programme on the Asian earthquake disaster.
All the people got frightened and they were screaming and they were... I can't tell in words what happened. All of them started crying and they all started to run.
Water is calm, you know. Run, everyone run, because aftershock. I go to high, I look down, oh, nothing to PB. 10 minutes, nothing. Yeah, nothing. Many people die.
As the water gushed through, it filled the room with water and I was almost drowned. And I just stood there and prayed.
Later in the programme, we'll be hearing from more survivors and people involved in the emergency and recovery work. But first, let's go back a week to the moment it all began. The earthquake struck last Sunday at 7:59 a.m. under the Indian Ocean, 100 kilometres off the Indonesian coast. In Hawaii, it was almost 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Christmas Day. Dr. Charles McCreary was in Honolulu at the United States Pacific Tsunami Warning Centre. Despite all the technology at his disposal, he said it took him a few crucial hours to appreciate the scale of what was happening.
What we saw first was large seismic signals, and 15 minutes after the occurrence of the earthquake, our center issued what we call an information bulletin, and it goes out to all of our customers in the Pacific. Because we had estimated the magnitude as an 8.0, we knew there would had been a local tsunami, and for a local tsunami, the wave is usually on shore within a few minutes of the earthquake. So the next indication we had that it was bigger was about an hour after the earthquake. The earthquake magnitude rose to be an 8.5. And at that point, we issued another bulletin, and we advised our customers in the Pacific that the earthquake was larger than we had initially thought, and we actually put a statement in that bulletin that said there's the possibility of a tsunami being generated near the region of the earthquake. Initially, even before we realized how much bigger it was, we had contacted Australia, their emergency management agency, to make sure they got word about this earthquake so that they could take any precautions they felt were appropriate for this event, and they did. They were aware of the earthquake. At that time, we did not still think that this was something that was going to be anywhere near as destructive as it was. The next thing that happened was that we began trying to monitor news reports about damage and casualties in Sumatra, but then we got, I believe it was a Reuters story that reported 150 casualties in Sri Lanka. So we knew at that point that there a destructive teletsunami had indeed been generated. The first people we contacted was our Pacific Command of our U.S. military, and I believe it was shortly after that we got a call from our U.S. embassy in Sri Lanka, and they were concerned about the possibility of additional tsunami waves being generated by aftershocks. Over the course of time, we kept monitoring these news reports, and of course, casualty numbers kept growing considerably and expanding to different areas. And it was really kind of during that time period that we realized this was bigger than we had thought. And I believe it was about 4 hours after the earthquake that we got the report from Harvard that uses another method to calculate magnitude, and they reported this as an 8.9, which that really, I guess, alarmed us the most, because that made it the largest historical earthquake in that region.
Dr. Charles McCreary there. Well, the difference between 8 and 8.9 may not sound like very much, but because of the way the Richter scale works, it actually means that the earthquake was nearly 10 times stronger than he first thought. But what actually happened under the sea? What caused the tsunami? Professor Bill Maguire is the director of the Benfield Hazard Research Centre at University College London.
You have one of the Earth's plates, the Indo-Australian plate, plunging down underneath the Burma plate, except it isn't running smoothly. What's been happening is for the last 150 years or so, the plate that's pushing down has been getting stuck and pressure has been building up there. And what happened on Boxing Day was that pressure was released, and so you had about 15 metres of movement almost instantaneously. And because the earthquake was very shallow, only 10 kilometres down, a lot of that movement jolted the water above it and sent the tsunami out to the east and the west.
10 kilometres down, that means 10 kilometres beneath the seabed.
Yes, that is extremely shallow for an earthquake. If the quake had been the same size but had been maybe 400 or 500 kilometres down, it would not have been a problem. It would hardly have been felt.
Now, you say west and east there, and this is a point I hadn't appreciated. One would imagine that the waves go in sort of concentric circles from the epicentre, but it wasn't like that, was it? They go in straight lines.
If the earthquake occurred just at one point, it would. But what happened here is that the fault, the plate boundary, ruptured along 1,200 kilometre length, which ran north-south. So Bangladesh to the north of that received virtually no tsunami. Some of the waves went east towards Thailand and Malaysia, and the rest of them went across the Indian Ocean and reached southern India and then on to Africa.
Yes, now let's think of Africa. Obviously further to go there, substantially further to go, and presumably by the time they reach Africa, some of the force has dissipated and the wave is smaller.
The energy is dissipated over distance, but nevertheless, over 100 people are reported dead in Somalia, so the waves were still significant in height. And the reason they can maintain their energy and their shape for such a long distance is because the entire sea is moving up and down. It's not like wind-driven waves where the wind just causes the surface of the water to build up into waves. This is the whole of the sea from top to bottom going up and down. In the deepest water, tsunami can move at 800 to 900 kilometres an hour, which is the same speed as a modern jet airliner. It's as if you have a long rope and you flick the end of it, you send these waves along the rope.
So what happened to ships? There must have been ships on the ocean when this wave came.
This is one of the other amazing properties of tsunami. In deep water, they are hardly detectable. They may only be tens of centimetres high. So they just go under the hulls of ships and they don't know that they've been there. When they approach shorelines, the waves slow down, and that means that the water behind starts to build up. So the speed is less, but they increase in height, sometimes 10, 20 times the height that they were in deep water. When this big wave comes in, the level of the water behind is about the same height as the wave itself. So you have this flood of water, maybe 10 metres high, that keeps coming in for several minutes. And then it takes just as long to go out again, and it will drag out the dismantled houses, wrecked cars, the dead, the living even. The living, in many cases, are dragged far out to sea and die at sea, can never make it back.
Tell us about what happens when the wave hits the shore. How far inland does the water go?
This will obviously depend upon the size of the wave and also the morphology of the coastline. If it's very, very flat, the waves can travel far inland, several kilometres. If it's a steep coastline, they won't travel so far inland. If there are estuaries or harbours, then the waves may be focused, they may increase in height and travel inland further as a result of that.
Yeah, I heard about a place in Aceh where a motor-launched boat was 4 kilometres inland.
Well, that's one of these very flat areas where the waves obviously would have travelled much further. Of course, as well, Aceh was very close to the epicentre, so the waves would have been biggest there, and they would have also reached it very, very quickly.
There was a report from Kenya, which seemed quite extraordinary, that some hippopotamuses were dragged from inland waters and rivers 5 kilometres to sea.
That doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, the strength and energy in these waves is just tremendous. For every meter and a half of coastline, one of these tsunami will deliver something like 100,000 tons of water.
Professor Bill Maguire there. Well, that's the science. What about the human impact? Well, one BBC correspondent, Roland Burke, who's normally based in Bangladesh, was taking a Christmas break in Sri Lanka when the wave came. He described his close shave with death.
Our room was right on the beachfront on the ground floor. Suddenly water was coming under the door. We leapt for the door. As we did so, the windows caved in, and suddenly we were out in the corridor, neck deep in water, fighting our way through the restaurant with the tables and chairs all crashing around us. We climbed up into a tree, stayed there for about 30 seconds, but that couldn't stand up to the incredible force of the water coming in. The tree came down, and we were then back in the water, trying to keep our heads above it, being washed along in a muddy torrent full of refrigerators and cars and bikes and roofs and bits of wall and other people. And we were carried along like that for about 300 metres inland, and we managed to grab hold of a pillar of a building and held onto that. And then the water stopped moving. It stayed flooded for a long time, but the initial wave had finished. And then gradually the water had subsided.
Others weren't so lucky. Everyone now realises that the wave contained devastating, ferocious energy, but at first it wasn't so obvious. The initial reports put the death toll at a few hundred, but hour by hour news came in from Indonesia, Thailand, India, the Maldives, and later from further afield, Somalia and Kenya, saying that the wave had come and people had died.
I lost my three kids and my wife. I escaped. I don't know how I escaped. My first son, 9 years. My second daughter, 3 years. My third kid, 1 year. I lost everything.
Everywhere there was water, people are panicky. Some people are looking for their children, and some of the rescue workers are bringing corpses of small children, and they were looking for first aid workers to give breathing and all that. They were seeking those things. So people are running. Some people who went to take their children and all that got stuck in the middle of the waves. And then I came here. All along my way, I met people, corpses were floating. Women got entangled with their hair to various things. Their long hair, they have got entangled.
Well, I could see this minivan was floating in the water. That is some 100 feet from the road towards the sea. And this minivan was just like traveling like a boat, just like floating. And I could see a few hands. They were waving their hands and all those things. And maybe I guess the level of water is almost 6 feet deep. So only people who could swim could have ventured out. And when the water has receded, I could see like people pulling out elderly people's dead bodies.
We were pretty much neck deep in water. And when I say water, I mean it was just complete filth. It was sewage, there was blood, there was everything that you can imagine. People's legs, arms were cut. I mean, when I was on the rooftop, there were probably about 5 people who had really serious injuries. Some of them were cut almost to the bone.
Well, by the end of the first day, 11,000 people were confirmed dead. States of emergency had been declared in the Maldives and Sri Lanka. A train on the eastern coast route of Sri Lanka had been swept away, killing more than 1,000 people. And the Sri Lankan president, Chandrika Kumaratunga, was one of the first leaders to alert the world to the enormity of what had happened.
The scale of the tragedy is massive. And Sri Lanka has never been hit by tidal waves or earthquakes or anything at all in its known history. So this is a very big tragedy which we have not been prepared for.
The Maldives, a chain of low-lying coral atolls, were devastated. Most of the capital, Malé, was under a metre of water. The country's president, Mamoun Abdul Gayoom, spoke to the BBC just 24 hours after the tsunami hit.
We have appealed for international help, and some donor countries have come in already. Our immediate priority is to provide relief to all the islands, to all the people who have been hit by these unexpected high waves. And we need a lot of medical supplies as well, food supplies and relief assistance from abroad.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with a special programme on the Asian earthquake disaster. Well, partly because of the relatively poor communications in the outlying parts of Indonesia, it wasn't immediately clear that the worst affected place was, in fact, the Indonesian province of Aceh, which lay right by the epicentre. The BBC's Indonesia correspondent, Rachel Harvey, was in Jakarta when the wave hit land. When did she first hear about it?
I got a phone call from London at about 9 o'clock Indonesia time on Boxing Day morning, so I was hoping to have a bit of a lie-in. I got a phone call saying that, just to let you know that we've heard there's been an earthquake in Indonesia. I thought, okay, fine. We get these reports so often that the instinct is, thanks very much for letting me know, we'll keep an eye on it, which is what we did for the next hour and a half or so. Check the local television, exactly the same thing, just running on local television, there's been an earthquake, and they were reporting it as around 6 on the Richter scale, no damage reported, no casualties reported. Now we know that the reason there was no damage reported and no casualties reported is because they didn't have any means to report anything. Telecommunications were down, electricity was down. No one had any clue about the scale of this. And then slowly, slowly, over the coming hours, the casualty figure started going up. Information came in very, very slowly, and the picture just got worse and worse and worse.
But in Jakarta, despite the size of this earthquake, you didn't feel it?
Didn't feel anything at all. It's only this northwestern tip of Sumatra that's been badly affected. The town of Medan, which is just over the provincial border, felt it, but really wasn't badly affected at all. There was no major damage there. In fact, the major relief operation is being run out of Medan. But elsewhere, no, we didn't feel it at all. And I think that's probably partly because of just the shape of Indonesia. It's in this sort of crescent shape, and it comes up on the northwest corner, and Jakarta, which sits on the end of Java, is slightly sheltered by that. So we really didn't feel anything at all.
And travelling from Jakarta to Aceh, because you made your way down to Aceh as soon as it became clear just how big this was, must have been like travelling from one world to another.
It was extraordinary. I mean, coming to Aceh anyway is a big culture change, and I've made that journey many times before to come and report that the conflict here between the Indonesian security forces and separatist rebels. And before, it's always been a bureaucratic nightmare. You need special permission to get here. You have to report in with intelligence and police and so on. This time round, they were obviously so shell-shocked. We did have to show ID. We had to wait a long time to get on the plane. The plane was then very badly delayed. But we were relatively lucky getting in as early as we did. Colleagues who've come in later have been delayed by a day or more trying to get on planes. Planes then can't land. But when we got in, the approach as we came in over the sea, the airport, you come in over the sea and you see the coastline, you could see just the way that communities must have been wiped out. I came in looking out of the aircraft window. You could just see the tops of houses and where roads had been washed away, maybe up to a kilometre or so inland. And from the air, it looked pretty bad. Then we spent the next few days, you know, wandering around at ground level, and it's much, much worse on the ground.
Rachel Harvey now in Aceh, where one woman in Thailand faced the most dreadful decision a parent can make: which of her children to save. Australian Gillian Searle was in the resort of Phuket with her two boys, one 2 years old, the other 5. With the water rising, she didn't have the strength to hold on to them both.
I had to let go of one of them, and I just thought I'd better let go of the one that's the oldest. And a lady grabbed hold of him for a moment, but she said that she had to let him go because she was going under. And I was screaming, trying to find him, and we thought he was dead.
She had made the right choice. The 5-year-old managed to survive. He was found 2 hours later, clinging to a doorknob. Well, most victims of the tsunami were villagers from the coastal areas, fishermen and farmers, but others died too in some places. Foreign tourists were on the beaches, particularly vulnerable to the incoming wave. Indonesia says its death toll could be more than 100,000. Sri Lanka now says over 28,000 were killed there. India estimates 14,000 are dead or feared dead. It's still impossible to tell exactly how many people from which countries have been affected, but some of the other latest official numbers include Thailand, 4,900, East Africa, 137 dead, the Maldives, 74, Malaysia, 72, and Burma, 59. Altogether, some 7,000 foreigners, 3,500 of them from Sweden, are missing, and many of those were on holiday in Thailand, where foreigners are estimated to account for more than half the dead. Well, one of the first worst affected resorts was, as we've just been hearing, from Phuket in Thailand. And Dominic Hughes sent this report.
Phuket International Hospital, where many of the injured foreigners have been receiving treatment. Standing at the entrance, I find Paul Ekdahl. He's just flown in from Sweden, where many of the foreign victims came from. He was called by his sister-in-law, Maria. She told him that his brother and their two sons, aged 8 and 6, were missing. They were swept away from the resort at Khao Lak. He doesn't expect to find them alive.
It's been too many days, I think, now. So, a small hope. We're traveling around, to different hospitals and putting up pictures and checking lists, but it's all we can do.
What made you come?
I was thinking like this, when if I hadn't done this trip, I would have been miserable in half a year or a month, I don't know, but I thought I have to do this trip. I must do what I can and help Maria down here. I knew that she was in bad shape, so I wanted to do the trip.
Inside the hospital, medical staff and volunteers bustle around, trying to gather and coordinate information on casualties. Volunteer Trevor Fisher is trying to do what he can to help. There have been many disappointments, but also a rare success.
We had a 2-year-old little blonde, beautiful child, unaccompanied. He was picked up off the beach in Khao Lak by an American couple. We took a picture of him, put it on the front page of the Phuket Gazette website. Within an hour of it going online, his other grandparents in Sweden had seen it, and they were reunited, and it was very special. We've not really had much success since then.
This is where they come to find the missing. It's Phuket City Hall, where the walls of the building are plastered with photos and messages pleading for information about lost friends and relatives. And each one tells a heartbreaking story. A picture here of Joanna Stigson and her two daughters, Kasia, aged 6, and 3-year-old Clara. Karen Bernhardt from Germany and her 11-year-old son, Yannick. And there are Thais here as well, Tanapat Suwana and Supapon Supatra. And around me, anxious people scan the walls, surely by now acting more in hope than in expectation. At the city hall, people also queue to register the names of the dead. Thousands of Thai families have been torn apart. But amidst the grief, there are some remarkable survival stories, like that of Uwea Yamarodin and her fisherman husband Mai. He lost a leg after a tree collapsed onto him, but still he managed to get free. Until she found him in hospital, Uwea didn't know whether he was alive or dead.
He looked at me and he was tearful. I was also crying. I was speechless when his leg was amputated. Our house was destroyed. We have nothing left. I felt so sad and kept crying.
Tourist areas like Phuket have an advantage over other badly affected regions. A reliable mobile phone network and a good supply of internet cafes have allowed people to post messages on websites. But a week after the disaster, the Thai authorities are now asking people to stay away from the Buddhist temples that served as makeshift morgues. They fear the spread of disease, and officials say bodies are now beyond recognition. But for those who don't know the fate of a loved one, the question of when to stop searching is a terrible dilemma to which there is no easy answer.
Dominic Hughes, you're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with a special programme on the Asian earthquake disaster. And if you want to get more information about what happened, or in particular on how to make a donation to help the relief effort, go to bbcnews.com/how to help. And there are links there to many of the websites of relief organisations and others involved in tracing the missing and in the reconstruction effort now underway.
Distribution of the BBC World Service in the United States is by Public Radio International and is made possible in part by individual donors to PRI whose contributions help bring innovation to public radio. Information at PRI.org. And with the support of the pharmaceutical company Merck, helping to expand access to its HIV/AIDS medicines for the world's poorest countries and those hardest hit by the epidemic. Merck, where patients come first. More at Merck.com.
Coming up in the next 30 minutes on this special program, what happens now? Governments and individuals are pledging money. How will it be spent? We speak to a UN official and BBC correspondent throughout the affected region about the mechanics of delivering aid. And a psychologist who studied trauma tells us about human resilience and how communities can overcome disaster and start the process of rebuilding shattered lives. But first, let's get a summary of the latest world news.
BBC News with David Ryder. A week after the massive earthquake under the Indian Ocean sent waves of devastation across a wide area, a series of international relief operations, aided by military aircraft and ships, are struggling to get aid to stricken areas. The Indonesian minister coordinating relief in Aceh praised the help of the United States forces. He said the authorities in the provincial capital Bandar Aceh were burying at least 3,500 bodies each day. Appalling weather in some areas is complicating a relief effort already made difficult by the tremendous destruction wrought by the disaster. Police in Thailand say thousands of local people are still missing, presumed dead, in one town in Pangar province, away from the main tourist resorts. A local police captain in Ban Nam Khem said he thought some 3,000 were unaccounted for, but as many were undocumented illegal Burmese immigrants, the exact figure would never be known. Eyewitness reports are beginning to emerge of the devastation on some of the Indian islands closest to the epicentre of last Sunday's earthquake. A BBC correspondent went to Car Nicobar, where 20,000 people lived on an island, the highest point of which is only 12 metres above sea level. He says half the population are still unaccounted for. The UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, Margarita Wallström, has spoken of a tremendous outpouring of international sympathy and offers of help. Ms. Wallström has been touring Sri Lanka, where the authorities are focusing on preventing the spread of waterborne diseases following flash floods, which have made a further 30,000 people homeless. Many roads remain impassable, and more downpours are forecast for later in the week. And one other story. The United States military in Iraq says at least 19 people have been killed near Balad, north of Baghdad. The Americans say a car bomb was set off alongside a bus full of Iraqi National Guards, in what was the most deadly in a recent series of attacks. BBC News.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with a special programme on the tsunami that hit Asian shores a week ago. Well, in the first few days, the relief effort depended on local people helping relatives and neighbours. They had to look after each other. Many government officials were killed and infrastructure, roads and water systems, for example, had been destroyed. Well, let's go back to Aceh now for a report from Rachel Harvey.
47 tents.
No labs.
One week on, outside help has at last arrived in Bandar Aceh. But they're only just starting to work out the logistics of what's likely to be a massive long-term relief effort.
You have a lab? Right, well maybe if we can get your lab with our chemical people and our treatment plant, and then maybe all the testing go to the one lab area till we get
effective coordination is crucial, but the organizational structure in Aceh was shattered. Many of the people who should have taken charge, local government officials, military and police, were dead. And international organizations had been banned from Aceh for a year and a half because of the conflict between Indonesian security forces and separatist rebels. Local groups had to cope on their own. Indonesian Red Cross volunteers load boxes of medicine and vitamins into the back of a van. It's a welcome change. For the first few days after the disaster, they were pulling dead bodies out of the debris, thousands and thousands of them. Jamjami Hagi says that because of the conflict in Aceh, he was used to dealing with corpses, but nothing could have prepared him for the horrors he's faced over the past week.
As soon as we heard the earthquake, we jumped in the vans. I don't have words to describe what we saw. We picked up one body after another until we had about 500. I had a team of 33 volunteers, but only one or two had gloves. The rest of us just used our bare hands.
A few streets away from the Red Cross post, another local group is concentrating its efforts on helping survivors. I'm standing in front of a row of shops, which are closed, but in front of them there are makeshift notice boards made out of upturned tables and bits of broken furniture. And stuck to the notice boards and to the walls and the fronts of the shops, there are hundreds and hundreds of pieces of paper with handwritten notices on them, appealing for information about people who are missing. Sar Husa comes from a village near the beach, but he was visiting his wife's family in town on Sunday morning. He was talking to his father on the phone when the line suddenly went dead. He hasn't seen his father or his mother since.
We haven't been able to find anyone from our village. Maybe they were dragged out to sea. Right now, we'd be grateful just to find bodies. I've heard my 7-year-old niece is alive, but I can't find her anywhere.
I've come down to the sea, to the coastal area where Sar Husa's village would have been, and there's virtually nothing left here now. You can see the foundations of some houses, but mostly it's just rubble and debris, mud, water. And there would have been tens of thousands of people living here. When you come to a place like this, you get a real sense of the extent of the devastation and how much help is going to be needed. It's going to take a very, very long time to rebuild this place.
Rachel Harvey with that report. Well, all over the world, people have been moved to tears by the images and the stories coming out of Asia, and wanting to reach out and to help, they have given money in unprecedented quantities. The government donations are getting bigger day by day. Altogether, governments have pledged over $1 billion. The UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, though, says the needs are not going to go away anytime soon.
On the question of fundraising, I think things are looking up. We are doing very well for the moment. But as I said, we are in it for the long term. And I will urge governments not only to contribute for the moment, but be prepared to continue the effort over the longer term.
Well, very substantial amounts of money are available. But how does that translate into help on the ground? Chris Kay is working with the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. He's in Colombo, Sri Lanka. What is the UN going to do with the money now coming in?
To be honest, Owen, we haven't got a huge amount of money yet, and certainly not as much as we would like. I mean, I think there's one thing about the pledges, which are fantastic. It's obviously on its way. Tremendous amount of resources that have been already mobilised. But the time that the pledges are made to the arrival of the funds actually to effect an operation takes more than 24 hours.
You've just turned up in Sri Lanka and seen the devastation. How do you go about working out what's needed? Who do you talk to?
I am talking to, at the moment, from the Centre of National Operations, which is the coordinating body of the Sri Lankan government. And the place is buzzing with people from the United Nations agencies, from the NGOs, as well as from the various government ministries. I mean, we really are working as best as we're able as a team to be able to jointly agree upon what the primary needs are and who's in the best position to be able to respond to those needs. There is a weakness, unfortunately, of the national capacity to coordinate assistance to determine needs, largely because many of the people who are responsible have lost themselves family members and so are traumatised. And we're actually finding that a large number of government officials are unable or feeling uncomfortable about even turning up to work.
And how are you fixed when it comes to getting into the Tamil areas and seeing if you can get equitable distribution of aid between the two, you know, communities in conflict in Sri Lanka?
Not a problem, actually. I mean, it's very positive on that call. And they see this potentially as a good opportunity to strengthening the peace process and reconciliation.
And then just a few practical questions on foreign aid and how it all works. When you are sitting there trying to coordinate it from the UN position, can you tell charities like Oxfam, Save the Children, who've got money now, look, it would be useful if you went there? If you tell them that, will they listen to you?
They do listen to us, and we've agreed, based on 10, 15 years' worth of experience, on how to work collaboratively together. And the evidence, I think, in the room just adjacent to me is testament to that fact, and as much that we're working alongside each other, all of us supporting the government in their efforts.
One last question for you. Are the stockpiles there in Sri Lanka, for example, at the moment, ready for distribution?
Warehousing actually is a problem right now. Distribution is a problem. Not that it's not happening. So far, civil society has played a very significant part in providing the relief to date. And recall that, of course, that whilst it would appear on the map largely that all of these towns in these regions are totally decimated, that's not the case. It's a 100 metres to a kilometre inland where the water has really caused the destruction, which doesn't necessarily mean that the rest of the towns and the resources available locally have been destroyed as well. So there's quite a possibility and plenty of options for, you know, local assistance available on site to come in.
Chris Kay there. Well, as Kofi Annan was suggesting just a moment ago, the reconstruction effort is going to have to go on for months and years. And let's now speak to some BBC correspondents, excuse me, covering different places now in crisis. And we're going to start with Francis Harrison, who's just come through. I'm told, Francis, you're in the north of Sri Lanka. Can you tell us precisely where you are and what you're seeing there?
I'm in northern Sri Lanka in rebel-held territory. I've just been to the town of Mulativu, or rather what's left of it. The wave came in, it destroyed cement buildings, government buildings, a church on the front coast, the main coastal road. There was huge destruction up to a kilometre, sometimes even a kilometre and a half into the land along that area. I've seen the rescue operation still underway. More than a week afterwards, LTT cadres, rebels, are collecting dead bodies in interior ponds, areas that are still flooded, and they say it's a very difficult job because the bodies are now decomposing, they're unrecognisable, they're actually very difficult to pull out of the water. And we went to one particular area where they'd pulled five or six out today, and they're having to go around with metal sticks, with boats, sometimes literally with their feet, looking for dead bodies under the water.
Now, normally, as I understand it, it would be quite difficult for you to travel to that area because of the conflict in Sri Lanka. Is it easier now?
Well, I don't think it was that difficult to travel here before. I mean, we did have an escort from the LTT to take us to the areas, and it is one of their security areas, but we've been here several times before. I've been myself to Mulativu in the past, and so I don't think that's made it any more difficult at the moment.
What I'm trying to get at is the access that you're getting and the amount, the extent to which the government is pushing aid to those areas.
Well, access hasn't been a problem in the past for the BBC in rebel territory, and it isn't a problem now. In terms of government aid, the Tigers say some has come in, but ordinary people that we met today who'd lost their families and their homes, fishermen on the coast, said that they hadn't received anything from the government, and they were quite bitter that in terms of the rescue effort, when people were stranded, they said that the government didn't send helicopters. Obviously, this is rebel territory. It's difficult for the government to do that, but they said, you know, as a result, people did die. They weren't saved in the way that they were in the south. So that there is that concern. The rebels seem to have done it to a large extent on their own and with donations from people from the south and from Tamil businessmen. They've used their own medical stocks to inject rescue workers to protect them against disease. And they evacuated the whole area along the coast, and they haven't allowed the public, civilians, to go back to that area because of the fear of epidemics of cholera and dysentery and so on.
All right, thanks very much, Francis Harrison there. And I think we're going to stick with Sri Lanka now and speak to Demetha Luthra. Can you tell us, Demetha, exactly where you are in Sri Lanka?
Yes, I'm in Kandy, which is in central Sri Lanka, and I'm on the way to Ampara
in the eastern coast, and that's the worst affected area, according to UNICEF. I've just actually come from southern Sri Lanka, from the town of Gore, which was also badly affected. And there the situation is improving. Their relief is getting through. It's only about 130 kilometres south of Colombo, and certainly trucks have been travelling up and down that road getting aid. And I've travelled actually further down to the southernmost tip of Sri Lanka, and there you could really see the full extent of the devastation. The wave had come in about 2 kilometres in, and everything was flattened. Every person I spoke to had lost someone, if not one person I spoke to said he'd lost 100 people, people he knew, cousins, uncles, aunts, in the tsunami.
All right, Dimitha Lusra, thanks very much for that, and we'll look forward to your reports from the east coast of Sri Lanka, where, as you say, there are indications that it's very badly affected, but not many people have managed to get there yet. Now, let's go a little north to India, and Daniel Lack, you're actually in southern India, aren't you, Daniel?
Yes, Owen, I'm in a place called Akkadapatti, which is right in the middle of the hardest hit area here in southern India, Tamil Nadu state, just south of Madras in the south of India. Right here is, I'm on the beach, and this was just prior to the 26th of December of last year, a thriving fishing community. Probably several thousand people with big mechanized boats, people who did quite well in their lives. Well, right now it's a wasteland. The boats are all piled up like cordwood, and they've just managed today to remove, they think, the last of the bodies. In this area alone, probably 1,500 people died of the 9,000 or so that India so far says it has confirmed dead. So this is the heart of destruction here in South India.
And the Indian government is saying it wants to handle the rescue effort, the aid work itself.
Yes, it is. Ambassadors in various capitals around the world, London, Washington, and so on, have gone on air to say we can do it ourselves. In fact, we're helping other countries in the region. That's true. They are. They've sent help to Sri Lanka, the Maldives, Indonesia even. But when you talk to the aid workers on the ground here, what they're saying is, look, it's a globalized world. We can globally help each other. For example, they could use sniffer dogs here. Could have used them all this week. It shouldn't have taken a week to find all the bodies. They could use lots of other help, too. It should all be shared, the burden of helping each other. So that attitude is not particularly popular amongst those at the sharp end here in South India.
Well, why is the government taking that line then?
I think it's national pride. I think that in Delhi there's a certain mindset that India, you know, is tired of being portrayed in the rest of the world as a poor country beset by disasters one after the other. But, you know, the fact of the matter is it does happen that some parts of this vast land do get hit by nature in catastrophe quite often. And in the past, India did need a lot of help. Probably the bulk of the help they received was from overseas. Now they can do most of it themselves. I'm seeing amazing outpouring of just volunteer help. Indians from all over the country coming in here and offering just ad hoc help to people, a helping hand, a hot meal, some new clothes, that sort of thing. But, you know, the country does need help on a grand scale with logistics and all sorts of things, and that's why people here would like to see India opening its arms to the rest of the world.
Daniel, thank you very much. Next to Anu Anand in the Andaman Islands. Now, only about 36 of more than 550 islands there are inhabited, and it's a strategically important place, a military zone. And for that reason, access has been difficult, and so it's not really been clear exactly what happened there. But Anu, I think some journalists have now managed to at least see some of the damaged areas.
Well, journalists have been able to go to one island, which is in the middle of this long chain, a chain of islands stretching some 1,000 kilometres. They've gone to the island of Kar Nicobar, and really what we suspect there is that there has been a lot of devastation. What I hear now is that the aid effort seems to be under control. What's more disturbing, though, is that the southernmost islands, 6 to 7 small islands, one of them only 90 kilometers from the epicenter of the earthquake, we don't have any independent information. The only information coming in is from survivors who are coming into the capital, Port Blair. And from them, we're hearing that these islands, some of them have been split into 2 or 3 parts because the ocean has just bisected them or trisected them. And we also heard today from survivors of the southernmost island, which is called Great Andaman, that bodies from Indonesia are now washing up on their coast.
Thank you very much, Anu Anand there in the Andaman Islands. And finally, we're going to Kylie Morris, who's in Thailand in the resort of Phuket, which, as we've heard earlier in this programme, was very badly affected with many foreigners there. becoming victims of the wave. Kylie, tell us what's happening in Phuket at the moment.
Well, there is a sense, certainly, that Thailand is going to recover quickly from this. I think the situation here is very different to other countries in the region which have been affected. That's not to diminish the suffering of people here. That's not to diminish the amount of damage that was done by this wave. But it must be said that these coastal areas, there's a ribbon along the coastline that has been affected. It's very popular among tourists. But more broadly speaking, the infrastructure of the Thai economy is in fairly good shape. Also, Thailand has picked up on that idea of national pride that Daniel was talking about. Thais want to help themselves through this. And so there's been a real sense of the nation pulling together. So in a sense, if anything good can come from this, it has been a chance for the Thais to show, to demonstrate the way in which they can cope with this competently.
But when it comes to the tourist industry, so important to Thailand, it's difficult, I imagine, for people in the West to think of going on holiday to Thailand in these circumstances. And yet, probably that's the best thing they can do, right?
Well, that's true, but I mean, you'd be surprised. I've just been down in Patong Beach, which is one of the main beach areas on Phuket Island, and there are lots of tourists here. I mean, people are coming regardless, it would seem. Admittedly, people aren't swimming very much, and we're not seeing them on the beach. But in some of these very popular areas, people are still taking the flights down from Bangkok, and they're coming back further out. I think islands like Phi Phi Island, for example, or that coast at Khao Lak, where so many people were lost, that will take a much longer time to repair, and perhaps people will not go back there. But certainly there's a sense in Phuket itself that already people are coming back.
I appreciate you're not an aid expert, but just from what you can see, if you could sort out one thing, what's the most important, the top priority thing to sort out now, do you think?
I think the top priority thing is actually the kind of small human business of identifying the bodies, actually. Really, there are so many traumatized people who you meet here who are simply trying to find their loved ones, many people who are flying from overseas and turning up to these mortuaries, which are incredibly difficult places to bear, and having to look at pictures of bloated bodies in order to identify their loved ones. I think if there was anything I could do to speed up that process so that people at least knew where their fathers, their brothers, their sisters were, and knew that they might be able to take those bodies home, then I'd do that.
Kylie Morris, thank you. Well, the reconstruction effort will doubtless try to repair homes and roads to get physical infrastructure back in place, but communities and families are going to have to be rebuilt too. And to discuss how that can be achieved, I spoke to Dr. James Thompson. He's a senior lecturer in psychology at University College London, and he's studied the effects of trauma caused by natural disasters like earthquakes, and he's run post-traumatic stress clinics for people from various disasters. So is there a typical process which people go through after experiencing a trauma of this kind?
And to begin with, people are surprised and disbelieving that something's happened. They're then shocked, and then they do whatever they need to run away. There is then a mixture of personal relief, simply at the fact that one has survived, followed by grief and anxiety about those who haven't. So the key thing to explain to those about those who have lost loved ones is that the disaster is not over for them. They still expect something to happen which will explain where their loved ones are. So after one has all this energy which comes up from the precipitating event itself, you generally find that although people are resilient, thereafter their capacity to function is somewhat reduced and remains reduced unless you have a community from outside that can bring assistance.
Really? Their capacity to function is reduced in what way?
When you get into the third or fourth day, just quite a number of people are not only physically exhausted but psychologically exhausted. They're still functioning, but they're not able to do the sort of clear thinking and organisation which happens in an ordinary situation. So what they need, you might say, is someone who helps them organise, helps them focus, and who shows them that there's an outside world which still cares.
Now, Dr. Thompson, if you can just stay with us for a moment, because I also have on the line now from Chennai in India, Shyam Prande of the Pan India Aid Organisation, SIWA. Now, I know you have, Mr. Prande, direct experience of what happened in Gujarat, where the people went through not dissimilar trauma. What lessons did you learn from that?
It was a very educating experience in Gujarat, as a matter of fact.
because of they have the enterprise in them, the activism in them, the thrust there was not on demanding the help, but on the other hand, trying to stand themselves.
What are you seeing down there in Chennai amongst the people who were affected?
We were visiting Nagapattinam, the worst affected district, yesterday. For the last 2 days, I was there over there. And we met a lot of people who have been, whose life has been destroyed almost. And there, people were expressing that they were crying, they were expressing that why they alone have been left here.
I'd like to ask you both, tell me about the situation when the head of the household may have been killed. If, you know, there was someone who was a fisherman, for example, sustaining his family in that way, really giving a boat to that family doesn't work because he's no longer with them and able to work.
In that case, we'll have to provide them with some alternate helping system. And we'll be looking for such cases. But then there is a very peculiar case this time around. In some of the villages along the coastline, the children were playing at the beach, you know, when the tsunami hit the coast. The breadwinners were on the sea fishing, and their mother folk were at home or had gone out somewhere. This age group, especially from 2 to 15, were totally wiped out. And this is one of the worst trauma, villages without children. And I would like to ask Dr. Townsend about this.
We have data which shows the replacement of children happens very rapidly. So there was initially a concern that parents would be too traumatized to start having children again. But in fact, it will happen. Certainly, there will be this massive gap that cannot be replaced in terms of actual persons and human beings. But those families will start having children again.
So, Dr. Thompson, really, inevitably, a disaster like this forces change.
It does force change. It forces change in family and social roles. It can force economic change. And if we try to be positive about this, there is a possibility now that the world may get itself together to provide aid properly and most of it will be well and promptly distributed. And one could then have, shall we say, a more balanced and more wealthy economy 10 years down the line. It will never compensate for the loss of persons, but yes, there could be a change which comes about because of a dreadful event. It's not usual, but it does sometimes happen.
Dr. James Thompson of London University there, speaking from here in the UK, and you also heard from Shyam Prandi in Chennai on the task of rebuilding communities after a major trauma. And that's it for this special programme on the tsunami disaster. And we'll end it as we began, with the voices of some of those caught up in the havoc that started without warning a week ago.
It was like a dream day, like it is every day here. It was sunny, no wind, no storm, nothing. And I could not imagine why the water would come now. I walked down a little bit towards the beach, and I saw that there was a huge flood coming. So I knew I would have to run up the hill.
When the wave came, two of my children were swept away from my hands. My other three children and my husband are still missing. I'm afraid I'll die now. I don't know how I can go on living here. The sea has become a graveyard.
Nobody knows that the waves will come. I don't know why. Normally they should warn the people, but nobody knows. The people go to the beach and then the waves come. Nobody was prepared.
As the water gushed through, it filled the room with water and I was almost drowned. And I just stood there and prayed. And then, fortunately, the water was so forceful, it blew the other window out. And, of course, then the water went down and saved my life.
I've come to an impromptu morgue. There's an 11-year-old girl who's just been screaming hysterically for some time, having just recognised her mother. There's also a man standing very close to me here now. He's holding the body of his 1.5-year-old boy. His wife is standing nearby, sobbing very quietly.
This is an unprecedented global catastrophe, and it requires an unprecedented global response. Over the past few days, it has registered deeply in the consciousness and conscience of the world, as we seek to grasp the speed, the force, and magnitude with which it happened. But we must also remain committed for the longer term. We know that the impact will be felt for a long time to come.
Why do bad things happen to good people? I'm Jim Fleming. Next time, under the best of our knowledge, we'll explore the question, what is a random act of chance? Does that mean it's God's will? Or, as Bob Dylan put it, is it a simple twist of fate? It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 Central Time here on WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, a chance of rain during the evening, then occasional rain and isolated thunderstorms after midnight. The low in the lower 40s with north winds around 5 miles per hour this evening, shifting to the northeast around 10 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, occasional rain in the morning, then a chance of rain in the afternoon, the high in the lower 40s with north winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.
So